Robinson. I'm head of exhibitions at the New Art Gallery in Warsaw. We're currently showing the Party exhibition, which hopefully you've all been to see, and if not, you can come over and see it. The exhibition features a selection of drawings that were commissioned from David Frigley for the exhibition. I just want to say, first of all, thank you so much to the College for hosting this event today. We knew that it would probably be very popular, and so it's great to have this kind of space so that more of you can take advantage of having David here with us today. And obviously David I'd also like to thank, because he's just driven up all the way from Glasgow, so literally having to come straight here and give a talk, so I'm sure it'll be fine. I'm sure you're all aware of David's practice. He's a very interesting artist, and to me he's a bit like the equivalent of the Renaissance man, the contemporary equivalent. Not only does he produce drawings, sculpture and installations, but his practice extends to music, to publishing, to merchandise, to writing a newspaper column and so on. So you don't want to hear me, you want to hear David. So I'd like to hand over to David, and we'll see you all later.
So, thank you, Deborah. I've got a microphone, but I can't really do the mic craft very well. So, can you hear me at the back? Yeah, is that good? Off a bit? Down?
No.
Is that all right? How's that?
Not very well.
That's good, okay. Not very well.
Hello. Okay, right. So about there, yeah?
About there. Is that good?
Yeah.
Is that good? Okay. That's good. Like daytime TV, isn't it?
What's your name?
Where are you coming from? So, I'm not that well prepared, but I don't tend to prepare. That's my strategy for everything. This was a talk that I think I did a while ago for the people that make Nokia phones, the people that design Nokia phones, and why they wanted me to talk to them is still a mystery. Actually, I'm not really sure why they are. Anyway, they paid me and it was fine. So I was thinking, what are the things that I've designed that are like commercial products? And I've designed these cruet things for salt and pepper, and I designed them for a museum in France. And the idea was that I designed them for the cafe, and that they weren't going to be for sale, and that if you wanted them, you had to steal them. That's what I said to them, and then it seemed okay, but then they started selling them, which I was kind of unhappy about. And then they started paying me, so I said it was okay. And I also designed recently some plectrums, novelty plectrums for playing the guitar, which they haven't sold that well, actually, but that doesn't matter. I designed a tube map. But it's not really a tube map, it's just the cover of a tube map, so it's not really a functional thing. But I guess I'm sort of best known for making gallery-based art, I guess, but better known, I guess, for doing drawings, but I do make sculptural work as well. And some people don't like my sculptural work, but I don't know what they expect me to do about it. I mean, except stop doing it, which isn't going to happen. So just get used to it. I also make photographs, or have made photographs in the past. Strangely, all the photographs that I made that are artwork that you might have seen in shows and whatnot and on greetings cards, I made all the pictures between, I think, pretty much all of them between 96 and 98. And then I was looking at my archive of negatives a while ago, and I saw that there's actually five of the images that I'm quite, that people recognize as my sort of signature photographs, are all on the same roll of 36 film. So I must have just had one really good day, you know. And this was one of these photographs. So. But anyway, I stopped doing it after a while. I guess a lot of them were just signage and sort of very transient public artworks. And I also designed tattoos. It's a kind of more recent thing that I've started doing, and sort of happened by accident, which is the way that a lot of things happen in my life, or in my career anyway. Somebody sent me a picture of a tattoo that they had done of one of my drawings, and so I put it on the website, and then it just became this sort of self-perpetuating service that I do for people. I don't really know how I feel about it, actually. I don't really like it. I'm not really that into tattoos myself. I just don't think they're classy, you know? Especially on women. I'm joking. I just don't think they're classy. I don't like them. I'm not the kind of guy who has tattoos. I'm kind of, you know, look like I should be from some errant royal family or something. And if I actually had tattoos when I took my clothes off, it would be really weird. It would be really weird if I took my clothes off, I suppose, in front of you. It would be inappropriate, perhaps. Especially in a college environment, where I am sort of a de facto tutor. I've designed record covers, done quite a few record covers. In fact, sort of done quite a lot of things in the music industry. This was a record cover for a band called Deerhoof, who are actually one of my favourite bands. But I've done a lot of stuff for people who aren't really my favourite bands and who I don't really even like that much because they paid a lot of money. Blur, case in point, don't really like Blur, but did a video for them because they got paid a lot of money to do it. And it was a good thing, you know, because I got a lot of money to do it. And, you know, and they let me do whatever I wanted, so that was cool. And I've designed book covers. This is a book called Why Do People Get Ill? And it's kind of some kind of pop medical type thing. Never read it. They never even sent me a copy of it. But I don't care. Doesn't matter. It's just for the purposes of the talk. So anyway, drawings. I guess drawings are what I do. You know, image, text, cartoons. That's kind of my... that's my bread and butter, to use an overused phrase. That's my sort of default setting. I started making drawings when I left art school. I studied in Glasgow many years ago now, and when I left, I figured that I didn't really think I could be an artist. This was 1991, and it was kind of prior to the sort of YBA successful Damien Hirst types, and I figured that I didn't do very well at art school. I only got a 2-2, and you get like a 2-2 in fine art just for turning up. So getting a 2-2 in fine art is like getting a fail in maths, you know. Or maybe just an ordinary degree in maths, but you know. It's very hard to sort of judge fine art academically. Anyway, I wasn't very good. So I left art school, and I figured I wanted to have some kind of creative practice, even though I didn't think I could be an artist. So I decided to make cartoons. I decided to be a cartoonist because I could do it in my room without a proper studio and without many materials. So I that's what I set about to do. And I guess in a roundabout sort of way, that's what I sort of became... That's how my career as an artist started, even though, in a way, I don't think I really intended to be a fine artist in the way that I am now, like having a sort of career and being collected and being a museum, says I'm in this art gallery, isn't it, that I hit. So, you know, commissions and all that kind of proper artist stuff, it wasn't really on my plan, so to speak. And because I draw in quite a crude way, and I did study at the Glasgow School of Art, which is all kind of, you know, life drawing and all that stuff, people often ask me, can I draw? You know, because obviously this doesn't demonstrate a sound grasp of objectively rendering three-dimensional space on a two-dimensional page. So I haven't done any life drawing since I was at art school, probably since long before I left art school, maybe even the 1980s was the last time I did any life drawing. So I did a life class recently, and the answer is no, I can't draw very well. So, there's that settled. My strategies, I was thinking about my strategies, and my main strategy in drawing is to fill the page. Obviously it seems quite a simple thing to want to do. There's the page and you've got to fill it. But that's really what my work's about, you know. I don't really think about it too much. I suppose I'm an intuitive artist. And I guess if you just stop thinking about it and just do it, then somehow for me it works. You know, I think it's more important to put the hours in and fill a certain amount of pages, and then the ones that work you keep, and the ones that don't work you throw away, and it's fine, you know. But well, I guess when you have some commercial success with your work, as I have, the drawings become valuable. You know, these pieces of paper become valuable, and then you have commercial galleries who get really freaked out when you email them this picture and say, Today I threw away 400 drawings. And I guess the ratio of success is probably, in fact, for the drawings, the piece I did for the show in the art gallery here was, I think it was 6 drawings, is that right?
I got 6, yes, but you said you did about 50.
Yeah, I did 50. So that's 12%. That's the 12%. And that's pretty normal. It's a sort of 12% success rate. How do I judge success? I don't know. I don't think about it. I'm the one who judges it, and that's all you need to know. So, another thing that's very pertinent to my work is that I'm a Virgo, and Virgo's kind of a pain in the ass. They like stationary rulers. This is just a tiny, tiny fragment of my giant collection of rulers. Another stationery. A lot of people here are Virgos, I'd imagine. I think it's probably the most common star sign. And like me, you probably love stationery, and you know exactly what I'm talking about. I also like diagrams, and I draw diagrams even when I haven't got anything to draw a diagram of, just diagrams for the sake of diagrams. I just love, you know, image and text and pointy things, and this is this and this is this, and wonderful. I guess my drawings are quite diagrammatic in a way, you know. They tend to be labelled objects on the page, or labelled renderings of objects, and maps are, I suppose, the most basic diagram, the diagram that we most commonly come into contact with in our lives. So I collect these maps, obviously, because I'm a Virgo, and they sort of have become, over the years, a document of my travels, travel to do exhibitions and whatnot to foreign places. Usually the maps are of how to get to a bar. Quite often they are how to get to a bar. This was 20th of August 1997. But I guess these things are, you know, when you go to a foreign country, sometimes where there's a language gap, you have these other maps which are just sort of a bit more gestural, and obviously there's no words on them because you can't talk to each other. And then when you go to Los Angeles, graphic maps aren't any use because of the layout. The place is so vast, so it's just a list of freeway exits and turnings. So they're all word maps. I guess, my drawing's diagrammatic. I mean, you can see what I'm talking about. That's what I kind of do, what I'm interested in. But I think I didn't really know I was interested in it until I actually started having to do talks about it. And now I've figured it out. So it's a kind of a good exercise to do a talk about your thing, because you sort of realise while you're talking about it what you're into. This is a guy called Ron Athey. And Ron Athey is a performance artist. from California, I think. And he is a sort of, he's got a lot of tattoos. But I think they suit him. I couldn't dress like that. I mean, if I turned up all covered in blood with loads of tattoos, I don't think it would work. But Ron is a, Ron does a lot of, he does these performances which involve a lot of bloodletting and bodily sort of mutilation, where he sticks hooks inside himself and blood comes out and stuff. And they're very interesting. And he did a performance at the Centre for Contemporary Arts in Glasgow, where I used to work in the days before I became a famous artist. And I used to build the props for the performances, amongst other things. And this guy, Ron, came, was there, I guess this is like early 90s, and he was describing what he wanted to do, and it was, you know, very dramatic. Also, he's HIV positive as well, which makes the bloodletting particularly contentious. He's a very sweet man, though, but he was sort of saying, so, I want to come on the stage with a big hook up my ass, and there's going to be pins and stuff, and there's going to be bloody rags going out into the audience, and I want to lie on a trolley, Dave, and I want you to make this trolley for me. And I was just like, wow, that sounds amazing. And it was quite a privilege to be able to make the trolley for Ron that he described so vividly. So I said, maybe you could do me a little drawing of the trolley that you'd like. And he did this drawing, and that was it. And then I guess, obviously, there was some paradox between the you know, grand gesture of the performance and the rather pathetic drawing. And if you've ever seen it, I mean, you may have some idea of what my craft skills are like, i.e. non-existent, but anyway. So another thing I'm interested in that I started thinking about was, obviously, signage is something that I'm really interested in, and a lot of my work involves signage. And I went on holiday once to the south of France with my girlfriend, and my girlfriend shares an allotment with this elderly lady called Jean Anderson. And Jean has this little house in the south of France, but she's rarely there. So, and she lends it to a lot of friends, and I guess she has to sort of label everything, so that firstly, so that people know that it's hers, and secondly, that, you know, because she's not there to introduce the guests to the ways of the house, there has to be this this information that she has to leave there as to what everything is. And at the start, it was, you know, it's very helpful to know what everything is for, and, you know, where everything should go, and, you know, that those things are hers and what they're used for, and that there are certain odd things that you wouldn't perhaps necessarily associate with their function. However, Jean is obviously a bit obsessive about it, because, I mean, obviously you need to know that that piece of foam is to be left at the bottom of the door in case of flooding, but the fact that there's another one with exactly the same piece of information on it on the other side of the door, I don't think you need to know. And likewise, it's good to know that that's a window wedge, but you don't have to write it on every one. So I was figuring Jean obviously just likes signage, you know, and, or maybe she just can't stop herself, or maybe she's obsessive compulsive, or, you know, maybe it's the same, all the same thing that we both suffer from, and that's why I was suddenly like, yeah, Jean and I are kind of the same, because that's the kind of thing that I do, you know, just kind of pointless. I'm not entirely sure. The thing is, I've never actually met Jean, so I don't know whether how she, you know, feels about it. And I mean, I spent the day photographing everything, but there was so much of it. You know, this is only a fragment, and it's actually a very small house as well. I mean, some of it is sort of, you know, it's almost like some kind of Joseph Cuthuth sort of philosophical thing. Ladder, please leave here. Useful also as towel rail, etc. And that's basically like saying, you know, this is what this object is, but it could be anything you want. You know, that's what Jean's saying. And I, yeah, something inside me likes these sort of statements, which are patently obvious. You really don't, you shouldn't really need to be told, especially if you can read, you know. And also, the thing is, the inventory that was there, that sort of described where everything was sort of incomplete, you know, and obviously had been long removed, and I don't know, it was like, and some of the things were too small to accommodate all the information that Jean wanted to write on them. So she had to add another object onto that thing. And some of them were just downright confusing, you know. Please don't move bike from here. Which sounds fair enough. But then you start to think, what if somebody's already moved the bike? Because it's not locked to anything. So where is here? And then you're thinking, yeah, that's a really interesting question that Jean is posing. So obviously, Jean signs, my signs, we like signs. I guess I like sort of posters, missive posters that tell you something about something. I suppose that's sort of like narrative in a way. It's kind of like giving you some information about something and you fill in the rest for yourself. And that's apparently how you make tell good stories. So I hear the sun, babies. I mean, obviously you don't need to know that's the sun, but you kind of do need to know that there are babies in there, because I can't draw that well. So, and maybe you need to know that that's a prostitute, because you wouldn't otherwise know. So context, obviously, context, as we all know, the context is half the work. In fact, the context can be kind of more of the work, more than half the work, I think. I used to make a lot of public art with these photographs, but that was kind of a short-lived thing, and the things I've done subsequent to that are sort of really big commissions like this. You cannot help looking at this. And somebody saw this. It's on the side of a building in Newcastle for some show that I was in. And he came up to me really angry. He was like, "Hey, Dave, what was that? That's really annoying, you know, because I was working in Newcastle and I walked past that thing every day. I couldn't help looking at it. And it really annoyed me. And I thought of you, by laughing at me, because it's sort of partly conceptual art and partly kind of gypsy curse, you know. You can't help looking at it. And I like that, you know, because I don't like things to be too serious. But then I quite like them to be a bit annoying as well. Annoyance is good. But, you know, please don't kill us. That's in the desert. Death. Drink me. I think the point at which I stopped making these photographs was where I realised that I couldn't actually stop. I was on holiday and I started drawing faces on all the pebbles on the beach. And then I just sort of thought, where am I going to stop? So I stopped. But these are some of the ones that I made. Matchsticks, firewood. This is about Lady Diana. Princess Diana, as she was when she died. I guess some of these things were... I think I realised that I was more interested in the photographs than in... I intended them to be like public artwork, because I sort of studied public art, environmental art, as part of my degree in fine art. And I sort of thought of these things as public artwork, but transient. But then after a while I realised I was just into the photographs, you know, it was the documentation that was the important thing. So I guess context, you know, these rely sort of on context for what they are. I suppose the tattoo thing is kind of a totally different context, you know, but it's a much more kind of slightly scary context and a slightly scary proposition for the person that actually takes on board the tattoo. On the first commission that I actually received for a tattoo was this young woman sent me an email to my website and said, "Would you design me a tattoo? Because I think your work's really great," and all that. And I was just like, again, I was like dismissive of the whole idea of tattoos, and I thought it was bad. So anyway, I did this drawing really quickly. Very, very quickly, as soon as I got the email, and I scanned it and sent it back to her. And then 4 days later, sent me another email saying, I've had it done. And I was like, oh, that's a really... But, you know, I understand why she wanted it done. You know, if I was to have a tattoo, I guess it'd be nice to have one designed by an artist that I liked. And I suppose that's what she'd done. But so I said, well, you know, maybe this is an important thing. Maybe this is something that I should patronize. You know, obviously, for me personally, I don't want any tattoos. But for everyone else, you know, if you're going to have a tattoo, then maybe I should be the one to do it. So, with that in mind, I've designed quite a few over the last few years. Anyway, I went to this, I said to this girl, could I come take a photograph of your tattoo? So I could put it on the website, you know, and we could, you know, it can be an ongoing project, and yours is kind of the first sort of thing. And she was like, yeah, that'd be great. So she was from Scotland, so we met in Glasgow on a Saturday afternoon. And I thought we'd go and have some coffee or something, and I'd take the picture. Anyway, there were two factors that were rather distressing at the time. The first of which was that she'd had it kind of done in a slightly intimate place, kind of, you know, downstairs, as it were. And that was, you know, yeah, that was slightly worrying. But the really worrying thing was she was 15 years old. So I was like, oh, God. I'm going to jail. So we went to my studio very briefly, and I took one picture, and she said, oh, don't you want to take another one? I was like, nope, that's fine, got it. Let's go and have some coffee. And then my friends who were in the studio at the time were like, Dave, what are you doing? What are you doing with that young girl? You don't want to know. So anyway, over 18s only, if you want a tattoo. I'm sure you are all over 18. Not that you'd want a tattoo from me, of course, but some people, for some inexplicable reason, like it. I didn't actually design that one, but it sort of illustrates how far you can go. And that you might... The thing about a tattoo is that at some point you are going to regret it. I mean, if you live long enough. And so there's the context, and I suppose I'm into misunderstanding the context as much as anything else. You know, I'm really into the whole Found magazine thing, and I've actually written things for Found magazine, because I find things, and one of my friends works in a charity shop in London, and he collects things that he finds in the coat pockets of the clothes that are donated to the charity shop. And I've got tons and tons of this stuff, and I was trawling through it one day. These are two sides of the same postcard. And I was always looking at this, and I was thinking, there is a real paradox between the image and, you know, the tone of what's written on it. Dear Edna Wall, having a nice time, whether unsettled, but having plenty of rest and plenty food. See you soon, Doris Ivy, whatever. And I was thinking, it's just weird. It's sort of really slightly formal as well, because it uses the person's full name, and then, you know, somebody that they don't perhaps know very well, but then it's an incredibly saucy postcard as well. But I suppose that's what's interesting about these things, is that you're left to fill in the context for yourself, to complete the story for yourself. I quite like deliberately misunderstanding things, and for a few years there, I used to do a regular illustration for Esquire magazine in Japan, and it wasn't very well paid, but I really liked doing it, because they just sent me an email. I never spoke to these people, and the only brief I ever got was this sort of broken English brief as an email, and it's hard enough to describe an illustration brief in words anyway, but, you know, when there's this, you know, it's not your second language, and it's a language that's so far removed from your own language, and the culture is so far removed as well, that it was just, you know, bizarre. So it was, you know, this is our request for the Esquire Japan May issue. The theme of this issue is, we love sweets. Japanese are captured the heart by sweets, such as cakes and chocolate. Not only women, but also men should have knowledge of sweets like food and wine in these days, therefore... The special story is about sweets that men should know as grown men. I was like, oh, what? They're talking about something, obviously, that sort of means something, but not to me. So I just do what it, you know, and I'd always send it on the day, you know, the deadline day. And I don't think the Japanese are allowed to say no, as far as I'm aware. Not that I've ever been there. So it was fine, and I did it for 2 years, and then the novelty wore off, and apparently, bizarrely, there was sort of very, when I sort of gave in my resignation, as it were, they were very disappointed, so, I don't know. I didn't understand what I was doing. And in that vein, recently I made a book a year or so ago in German. Hand being is the title of the book. This is the cover. Hand being the same word in both languages. And it was in German, translated by me, but I don't speak German. So what I did was, there's a book that I'm very fond of, which is called English as She Is Spoke. And the premise for that book, it was published 120 years ago or something, by a Portuguese guy called Pedro Carolina. And for reasons best known to himself, he decided to write an English phrase book, even though he didn't know any English. And he only spoke Portuguese and a small amount of French. So he got an English-French phrase book and a French-English phrase book and translated this thing like that. So it's just really bizarre, really kind of surrealist masterpiece. But I don't think anybody really knows quite what his intentions were. So anyway, mine was the same thing. I also speak very rudimentary French, but speak no German. So I got an English-French dictionary and then a French-German dictionary and then produced these drawings that I kind of do in my own way, most of which were sort of just text. But I didn't actually know what I was writing. And I got the people who published it actually edited it slightly so that the grammar was a little bit better. But it was kind of funny because on the publication of this book, I was at the launch party and, you know, all these German people were reading it and they were like, this is really funny. And but I just didn't know why, because I'd done it very quickly. And then they sort of translate it back for me. But I really enjoyed the fact that I'd published this book that I'd written that actually meant something, but I didn't actually know what it was that it meant. And for some reason, that was amusing for me. I mean, I don't think it was a fantastic book by any stretch of the imagination, but it was a very interesting book, so my German friends tell me. This was one of the first books that I published with a small press in London, and it was called, this was the cover of it. And it's sort of, the idea of the book is that it's an erratum for another book. So it's a much larger book. So it's a list of all the mistakes in another book. And it's called meaning to deviate or make a mistake or whatever. But I actually really like the fact that you'd go into the bookshop and say that, can I have a copy of yes, by David Shrigley, yes. Sorry, it's, we don't have it. And it was translated into Swedish, which obviously really amused me, because every person in Scandinavia that I've ever met speaks better English than I do. So why they wanted to translate into Swedish, I don't know, but you've got to say yes when somebody asks. And Finn is apparently not a great translation, but anyway, it's a poor translation. And it was a silly idea. I recently, well, a while ago, received a handwritten note, which apparently was from the comedian Dylan Moran, who is a big admirer of my work. And I got it out, and I've never quite been able to understand what it meant. I mean, his handwriting's like that of a GP. I just can't understand what he's talking about. So I'm not actually sure if he was even really giving me praise or, I don't know, just pointing something out to me. But I quite like that. I guess this is sort of an example of automatic drawing. There's a very famous surrealist called Henri Michaux who used to take LSD and do all these sort of abstract, crazy drawings and paintings. And this picture that I did was, I was on the phone to somebody who had phoned me up out of the blue, and I just didn't know who they were, and I didn't want to talk to them, and I was just like, but I'm kind of shy, and I don't really like sort of telling people to go away, and, you know, asserting myself. So instead I was like, yeah, that's fine, yeah, okay, I can do that. And then at the end, after the phone, after the conversation, I realised I'd done this drawing in this sort of state of high agitation. And it sort of occurred to me that it was sort of like the same thing as Henri Michaux was doing, you know, whereby he sort of wasn't really aware of what he was doing. It was like automatic drawing, but he took LSD and I was just on the phone to some horrible guy. I found this in a phone box. And I know what a beard is, and I know what a caress is. And I guess I can figure out what a beard caress is, but, you know, what... Yeah, there's only one way to find out. But I haven't quite plucked up the courage to do it yet. So anyway, this is from my friend Rupert, who collects these things for me. He likes... This is... He finds all these notes, which obviously mean something in context, and are very rational things in context, but out of context, you know, you misunderstand it. And they start to become, when I read them, they suddenly start to become a bit like short poetry or haiku or something. To whom it may concern, all these specks are for short-sighted eyes. It's like the more you read it, the more profound it becomes. For me, anyway, I don't know. But I suppose I just sort of say things over to myself and they become profound. So, mistakes. I used to do a cartoon for The Independent on Sunday. It's probably about, I don't know, 12 years ago now. And it was going well. And then after a while, they started to misprint what I did and leave the text off, more crucially. This is a drawing of a Christmas tree with a polystyrene cup on the top. But underneath it says something like celebrating Christmas with the dope smokers or something, which doesn't really, it's sort of a very ambiguous thing to say anyway. But when you leave the text off it, it doesn't mean anything. And it really used to annoy me, and it happened week after week. It was every Sunday. And the straw that broke the camel's back was time to reflect. And they printed it like that, you know. I was just like... So anyway, that gig ended. And then I started working for The Guardian, and I put a box around what I was doing. Like, everything inside the box you're not allowed to touch. And that kind of worked. And then I got the sack, like everything. So this was herpes. Yeah. Shall I tell you the story about herpes? I don't know. We might be kind of running a bit short on time. We'll save that for another day. My website, I guess, has sort of facilitated a couple of projects, the tattoo project kind of being one. And the other one was this poster project that I did, because I did a lot of illustration. It occurred to me that I kind of see illustration projects as like some kind of drawing exercise, because I assume that everybody knows that I can't really draw very well, so they're not really asking me because they think I can render things really well. So I put this ad on my site that said I would do a poster for anybody that wanted one, for a party or a gig or whatever, or any kind of event. And the only proviso was they sent me the information and they just accepted and displayed whatever I produced. So I just, you know, made these 300 posters over the course of a few months for people. And I sent the digital image and they posted it out, and then they sent me a photograph back of the thing in situ. And so it was kind of just a sort of interesting thing to do, and it was sort of somewhere in between my work and a really sort of functional project. And eventually I showed it a couple of times in a museum context or gallery context. I quite like the fact that it's sort of really awkward, whereas people recognize my work and have expectations of it, but then they have this, all these drawings which sort of don't really make sense, or they refer to actual real events that have been and gone. And I kind of like that. Sorry, going in the wrong direction now. I kind of like that awkwardness. I like the defeating your own thing, you know. Dear David, please find enclosed the catalogue of the show Irony and Jester at the Youth Gallery. As you will see, they unfortunately misspelled your name. I mean, I guess I like it when things like that happen. Although obviously the gallery didn't like it, but These are my collection of things found on the photocopier. This was the cover of a cassette tape. In the old days, before CDs, we used to make cassettes, recorded cassettes with compilations on them for our friends and girlfriends and whatnot. And this was one that my girlfriend many years ago made me. And I got it. I kept it for sentimental reasons. But then I got it out and I found it one day and I was thinking, so there are traffic lights, right? Why is it all red? And I kind of really bothered. But again, a sort of misunderstanding that, I don't know, maybe I don't really want to know the answer to. So this is my friend Rupert, who works in the charity shop. And I think we've been doing it for a few years now. And probably hit the mother load a couple of years ago where he found a dream diary, which is from, I can only guess what era it's from, perhaps the 60s or 70s maybe, I don't know. But I'm guessing a middle-aged married lady who's in detail written down her dreams over many, 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 many nights. And it's a really fascinating thing. And too nice, in a way, for Send to Found magazine, because they're a bit mercenary about these things. But then, kind of fascinating, but there's a sort of also awkward voyeurism as well, which makes me think, am I supposed to be reading this, and for whose benefit did she write it down? So anyway, I don't know. I think there's a lot of that in Found magazine, whereby they publish notes that, you know, where some boyfriend is dumping his girlfriend or vice versa, and I think that's sort of slightly problematic. So, mistakes, A to B. And I mean, part of my work is it just happens A to B. I'm sort of interested in the what happens along the way. You start a project and the work just seems to sort of happen along the way and you don't really know what's going to happen. This is the cover of a record that I made called Worried Noodles. And these are actually just paintings from an exhibition that happened to be square, so I used them as this record cover. And this German record label asked me to do a record cover for one of their bands quite a few years ago. And I didn't really like any of the bands on their label, so I kind of left it for a long time. I didn't tell them that, obviously, because they were nice guys. So I did a t-shirt and stuff, and then they were like, why don't we do a record cover that's just artwork, and it's just an artwork, and it doesn't have a record in it, it's just got an empty record sleeve with a dust sleeve in it. So I thought that was a really nice idea, and then when I started doing it, I figured it wasn't quite enough, and nobody would really want it, so I made this songbook with all these, that sort of had these lyrics, that they were just sort of lyrics, just sort of maybe mimics the way that one writes lyrics on sort of the inner sleeve of a CD or something, and they're just sort of handwritten. You can imagine that Lennon and McCartney have written them. So I didn't really have any intention for them to be sung or to be, you know, they're just sort of stupid concrete poetry, I guess. And I don't know, that meant, and those drawings in the book as well, and that seemed to sort of be enough. But then, kind of inevitably, I suppose, we published this, and it was, I guess, quite successful in its own way. It's sort of sold out. It was a very modest publication. But they asked 39 bands and performers to make songs based on my lyrics. And some of them were really quite famous, like David Byrne did one, and Franz Ferdinand did one. And this, a lot of bands that I'd never heard of as well, but it's kind of mad that I'd written a song for David Byrne, you know. And strangely, I actually get royalties, and I make quite a lot of money from having written the lyrics to these songs.
It's just bizarre, really bizarre.
Anyway. It's still available if you want to buy it. It's kind of interesting, kind of crap, but kind of good. This is a photograph that I took of my friend Stan when we were having a party, and he was dressed as an Easter bunny, and he got red eye with the flash. And I was like, how cool is that? He's dressed as an Easter bunny and he's got pink eyes. This was a piece that I made. It's called Crushed Ladder. And I showed it in a show that I did at Commercial Gallery in New York. And I kind of liked it. They were like, oh, a crushed ladder. How did you make that? It's fantastic. It's like, I've got a ladder. I crushed it. And somehow that was enough, you know. I wasn't taking the piss. It was for real, you know. It was, I liked it. I wish, you know, I wish they hadn't sold it to a museum. I wish I still had it and not all the money, but I don't. And I also went through a phase of filling things with expanding foam, as you do. It's a lot of fun, obviously. Not to be run again until Jesus returns. This is my cousin, Nigel, who has a finger missing. A lot of people who look at this photograph don't actually realise that he's got a finger missing, because they made a pretty good job. He had like sort of some hand surgery when he was a kid, and I took this picture of him because obviously you know what I mean. And you, I don't know, I've got a really big potato. What shall I carve it into?
A skull. Cool.
My girlfriend said, is that supposed to be me? And I was like, no. It's me, it's on my side of the bed. Why do you always think everything's always, always about you? I can say that because she's not in. The story. So I'm into stories. It took me a while to figure out that I was into stories. I guess that's what I'm doing, you know. The page is, each drawing is a page, is a story. It's just a fragment of a story. And you're allowed to fill in the beginning and the end of the story for yourself. Some of it is slightly autobiographical as well. Men down the hole. We've all been there, haven't we, guys? It's great down here. I'm really enjoying myself. Yes, it's great to be away from our wives. This is a gravestone with a shopping list on it. Feel really bad about this, don't worry, it's fine. Ding dong. So, I've done quite a bit of taxidermy as well over the years. It tends to be a lot of things without any heads. I don't know why that is, but it's expensive, and a lot of them don't sell, and I've done one recently that cost a lot of money, and the gallery's really annoyed with me, and I don't care. Money comes, money goes. Exhibition of spiders. Teeth. So, teeth, yes. If you want to buy teeth, it's really difficult to do it. You're not allowed to have them. You go to the dentist and say, can I have some teeth? And the dentist says, only if they're yours. And that's the rule, apparently. So I had to get these on the black market. And then you actually need dentist drills to drill into them. It's kind of obvious when you think about it, but you can't buy drills from B&Q because they just don't work. Because teeth are really hard, apparently. Obviously hard. Anyway, I think this is going to work. Yes, it's going to work. Cool. So, films. I've done a lot of films, and in a way, I guess I've done a lot of work in my life. I think I got to about 35 and realised when I did talks like this, it was impossible to show all the work I'd done. Not that that makes me big or clever or anything, it's just that I'm probably a bit over-prolific. But I made a lot of films, and this is actually quite a recent film that I've made. I just showed it a few weeks ago in an exhibition. And I guess it's sort of a lot of the films that I make, which aren't like pop videos or commissions or whatever, they're kind of like this. They're just, they're about stories, but you're kind of just telling a story in the most economic way you can. I work with an animator, and we just work together, and he's kind of not a very good animator because I'm not very good at drawing, so it kind of works really well. So I guess once, about 3 or 4 years ago, a film that I made won an award, and it did quite well at a film festival, and I got given some money by a production company, quite a lot of money actually, to make a feature film, to write a feature film. And I thought it was really cool, and I got a book out of the library on how to write a script. And then I did it for 2 years, and I realised that I just didn't want to write. I didn't want to write anything that was 90 minutes long, because I think everything that you do should just be the length that it is, or that it needs to be. When you're telling a story, you don't want to tell, you don't want to tell the story in a more long-winded way than you actually have to. And I guess that's sort of the secret of filmmaking, is that you kind of, you don't tell people too much. And eventually I wrote this script for so long that I realised I just didn't want to do it, and it seemed somehow slightly conservative. We have to have all these characters and story arcs and things that I just, it was just impossible. So I just went, I gave the money back, and I said I can't do it. So, and they were really pissed off with me, because there were a lot of people who were kind of depending on kind of making the film with me, like a producer and co-director and all that stuff, and the animator, and they were all really ticked off that, you know, you've given all this money back. What do you mean you've given the money back? And I was just like, I just don't want to do it. I just want to make really short films that I can pay for, and I don't have to go to any meetings. So that's another thing about films, you have to go to like hundreds of meetings. You can tell I'm just rambling now until this finishes. It does end, but you get end. You kind of know what's going to happen though. So that's why it's called ones, obviously. But anyway, that being the point, I guess the story doesn't need to be, it just needs to be as long as it is. And I paid for this myself, and it's done. And it doesn't matter if it's crap, but it's my thing. So, yeah, I guess that's it. I don't like to talk for too long, because I'm afraid that I might be boring you. So, thanks for coming. So anyway, if you want to ask me a question, you can ask a question, but you don't have to. That's also fine. No questions? Good.
Give us a minute. Anybody got any questions? No? No, maybe they
have
to go.
You've got to go.
David,
you can ask me a question. Well, I wasn't really aware that it was well respected, but I'm very glad that you did. The thing is about that record, I made a spoken word record, which I didn't talk about here, but it was, I just made some, wrote some stuff, and I made it with a friend, and he put music to it, and it's kind of, I don't know, just sort of weird, odd spoken word stuff. And I think the problem with that project was that the record label who did it weren't really that into it, and it never really got much exposure. And I just kind of did it because they asked me to do it in a way. And I never really intended to be a musician. I mean, I've been in bands and stuff years ago, but I can't really sing, and I'm not very good at playing the guitar. And I only ever did it just to sort of as some kind of personal thing that I wanted to do, because I'm really into music. But and also I like making the spoken word stuff, because it is sort of an extension of my work, in the sense that it's like a soundtrack to a film or something. It's a narrative thing, I suppose, like I've been trying to talk about. But yeah, I'm really glad you like it. I mean, I'm surprised you've heard of it, to be honest with you, because a lot of people are totally unaware of it, and it's not really part of my thing. But I'm making another spoken word record at the moment with a guy called Malcolm Middleton, who used to be in this band called Arab Strap, and he's a friend of mine. So we're doing that, but I don't know whether it'll be as good as the last one. Because I don't know. The thing about that record also is my criteria for doing it was that it wasn't going to be shite, and that was it. You know, I just thought, well, if I do it and it's not shite, then that's fine. And I think that's probably a good policy for everything that one does in life. Just do it. And if it's going to be shy, don't do it. And if it isn't going to be shy, then do it. It's fine. I mean, there's no money to be made. Although, strangely, talking about the royalties, there's one track on that, which is the one called Dunce. It's like, don't put your hand in the blender, or whatever. and it just goes on like this, and it's got a soundtrack. I make loads of money out of that, just because it gets played on the radio. But where? Who plays it? I mean, I've never, like, there must be somewhere in, like, I don't know, Iran or somewhere, but they've got, or New Zealand, or some college radio station that's really into this very peculiar track that I made. And I made, literally, I made like hundreds of pounds every year, which is not a lot of money, but it's hundreds of pounds for doing something that's just like sort of really strange. But anyway, thanks very much for liking my crap.
Now, you're drawing, Stalia, and the way you write words and that, do you deliberately write like that, or is that just naturally?
It's real. If I write, when I write
a letter,
it's uppercase. So, I mean, I don't write in uppercase all the time because it sounds like you're shouting at somebody, but that is my real uppercase, and it's not sort of faux writing. So people often comment that I write their address on the front of the envelope, and it's the same as the drawings in my books.
Wow.
Is that surprising? I don't know.
I was really interested by what was in the bag of drawings that you always throw away, and like what makes a drawing unsuccessful, because a lot of them you've sort of scribbled out the writing and then written it again, but you haven't decided to throw it away. So how come you don't care if you've scribbled it out and written it again, but all these ones are apparently wrong?
Because there's another criteria that's more important than whether it's spelled right.
It's not like the right idea.
Well, no, everything's unique. I don't do anything twice, so it's just, that's just the way that I sort of think about it. And I think the criteria for me probably is just whether it's sort of new and different to everything else. But if it's sort of like another drawing that I can remember doing, then I'm just like, well, it seems familiar somehow, so I throw it away. And I guess that's it. Or if I just think it's rubbish,
if you make a mistake, like sometimes when you're writing, you make a mistake, you just scribble it out and write again. Do you never think, oh, I've done it wrong, I have to start again?
No, because I don't like sort of doing that. I never do it twice.
And
aesthetically, I suppose it is a deliberate aesthetic to a certain extent, not to correct things with Tippex, but Tippex, I'm Virgo, Tippex isn't archivally sound, and I'm slightly obsessive compulsive, so obviously that's not going to work. And then probably if I don't scribble things out, then, you know.
Obsessive compulsive. If I was to do something wrong, I'd have to rip it up and study it again.
Well, it's not really, it's not about neatness, it's just about the thing you do. It's just like, my, you know, if I don't cross it out, then my girlfriend's going to die, you know. Quite that dramatic, you know, because she's still alive. Well, that's because I cross out, she's still alive. I've got to keep it going. I mean, you know, we're getting married, so I can't kill her.
I'm just wondering, do you find, or did you find, when you were starting
Well, I think like a lot of students, I used to find it very awkward to explain my work. And on the occasions when I teach in art schools, as I do from time to time, and when I give tutorials to students, I'm always really aware of that, and I try and think about when I was a student. And I don't really ask students about their intentions. I sort of treat it like Freudian psychotherapy, you know, and I ask them lots of questions. You know, I ask the student to heal themselves. You know, or to teach themselves. I suppose that's what teaching's about. But I've always found it, I can't, you know, it's very rare that I ever come up with a proposal for something. I mean, obviously, if there's tons of money involved, I'll do whatever they want me to do. But, you know, I think a proposal is, for me, is in some way ingenuine because of the way that I work. Because my criteria is to, a lot of the time, for instance, right now, I'm making an exhibition, and I've got a certain space to show in, and the way that I work is just to have a certain amount of materials and a certain amount of time, and a friend of mine who's helping me do it, and I've got a budget, and once the materials are used and the budget's run out, and that's it, finished. And for me, that's the way I work, and whatever happens, happens, and it always sort of seems to work, because, I don't know, it just does, that's just the way I work. I'm just sort of intuitive person. But, you know, like when I was at art school, and probably why I didn't do very well at art school, is that I couldn't tell people what I'd intended, because I didn't intend anything. I just intended to spend X amount of time doing something. And, I mean, obviously, there are things that I'm really interested in, and things that I've learned about my work, but I've only learned it through doing it. And I think the important thing about, for me, about being an artist, and the thing that I've learned about how to make work, is just to put the hours in doing it, and just do it. If you want to make a film, just make a film. Get a camera, get as many days and resources as you need, and just make it. And then, you know, it will happen.
So
if you put the hours in.
It's like a, yeah, build it and they will come. Kind of build it and they will
come. I think if you put the hours in, it happens. And if you don't, if you spend the time looking out the window, waiting for inspiration to strike, it probably won't happen. But, I mean, that's the way it happens for me. Everybody's very different. I mean, my friends who are successful artists as well, you know, probably work in very different ways. And, you know, they start off in the library or something when they want to make a piece of work, but I don't. I start off with a, metaphorically speaking, with a blank sheet of paper, a blank page, and I fill it up. And my only job is to fill the page. And you have not been given a job. So I'm misquoting there anyway. Last question.
You're obviously incredibly prolific and tons of ideas, and it looks as though you have all the time. Have you ever had the equivalent of writer's block, an artistic block, where you really just haven't known what
I have good days and bad days, as my grand used to tell me. I have good days and bad days. But I still put 8 hours in, you know. Or maybe 6 hours is okay if you're doing something really creative. But if you're doing something more labour-intensive, I think you have to put 8 hours in. So I don't stop. You know, I often get frustrated and bored and fed up with my own work, but I still do it. Because that's the only way that you can do it, is just to put the hours in and just do it even if you don't want to. Just force yourself to do it. And I think you can never predict what's going to happen with your own work. I don't think it will, everything. I think everything sort of happens by accident for artists, for everybody, even though, you know, even people like, I don't know, like Martin Creed, who's sort of an arch-conceptualist, I think he, you know, his work comes about by accident. You know, I think that ideas just drop on your head like bird shit. There's nothing you can do about it, unless you stay indoors sometimes. So, well, you've been a wonderful audience. I've really enjoyed speaking to you. And I kind of need to sit down now.
Yes, can we thank David once again?